Shoot the Defence, the best podcast in the world. We're out here.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we had now taken our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, that's sending a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defence. I'm your host, Stel. This is my top five matches. And my guest is the football writer. He's a blogger. He's part owner of the Bola Bola show. It's Sivan John. Sivan, how you doing, mate?
Hey, everyone. I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me on this podcast. Yes, I'm pretty much excited to talk about the five football matches which I've picked. I'm sure they're not the most memorable by most people's expectation, but I'm sure you'll find them very interesting.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And before we kick off, mate, just like to say, I really enjoy your podcast, the Bola Bola Show, especially the retro stuff, you know, your memories about Blackburn winning the title, although being a Man United fan, it's not a great time.
Sure.
But your Newcastle one was decent, and I'm pretty sure they'll go from strength to strength.
Yes. I mean, right now we're in the middle of a lockdown because of COVID-19. So, you know, what's best to talk about? Talk about, you know, some of the great things that happened in football in the past. So, yeah, Blackburn Rovers winning that season, 94-95 season is, you know, that's one of an interesting season to look back. Just as much as I'm sure, you know, United fans would like to look back at, say, 99 or 96.
Hmm? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, 99... Yeah. Won't ever be replicated, I don't think. Anyway, well, not in my lifetime. And there's many years that we could talk about as United fans. We've had some barren years as well, don't get me wrong. But, yeah, they've been mostly good. The 90s were good for Man United fans. That's what I have to say about that.
Yeah.
There you go. All right, well, let's talk about your top five matches. And we'll go in chronological order. The 1986 World Cup final between Argentina and West Germany. Now, the Germans were powerful, weren't they? I mean, they got out of their group. I think Denmark topped the group, and then they beat Morocco, Mexico, and France on their way to the final. Whereas Argentina topped their group. They beat Uruguay. They famously knocked England out and beat a very, very good Belgian side en route to the final. So, yeah, why was this game so memorable for you?
Well, it's my first ever watching a football match live on TV. Mm-hmm. The first time ever I'm watching a full game live. I didn't get to watch most of the 86 World Cups live. Most of it was recorded by my uncle. So when the World Cup final came about, I was really, really excited to watch. I was only 6 years old then, so you can do the math. So how old am I right now?
We're the same age.
The game was pretty much in the early hours. So, you know, I had to sneak out of my room because, you know, as most adults, they wouldn't want a six-year-old boy not getting enough sleep, you know, getting cranky the next day and all that. But, you know, I made it a point that I had to watch this game. And I was in the living room with my uncle watching it in the early hours. It was pretty much I would say it's one of the most exciting final. You know, it wasn't good at the moment. It looked like Argentina was just going to walk away with the World Cup, but Germany, being Germany, you know, when they play football, they don't play up to the 90th minute. They play until the 94th minute. That's what they say. And they came back 2-2, and of course, Buruchaga scoring the winning goal, you know, giving Argentina their second World Cup. Pretty much as, I would say, as Maradona's legacy as one of the all-time greats being sealed there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was fantastic in 82. 86 was undoubtedly his defining moment, and people always talk about Maradona being better than Messi because he's got that World Cup under his belt. But let's concentrate on this game. And as you mentioned, Germany fought back to equalise 2-2. Rummenigge and Rudi Völler, two very, very good strikers. And you'd have thought that blowing a two-goal lead, Argentina wouldn't have the character to go on and win this game. Perhaps it would have gone to extra time and even maybe penalties, because we know how good the Germans are when it comes to spot kicks. But yeah, as you said, Buruchaga broke away. It was a fantastic counter-attacking goal and a well-deserved win for Argentina.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, when the game was at 2-2, you know, I mean, bear in mind, I was 6 years old, so I really wouldn't know exactly how long more the game is going to take. But now, looking back, you know, when you think of it, you have to imagine that if Argentina didn't pull away that third goal, there's a possible chance that World Cup could have slipped as well. As you have mentioned, Germany on penalties, they're extremely good. I have not seen Germany losing on penalties in my lifetime, so I have no idea, you know, what could have happened then if they could have just dragged the game up to extra time and all the way to penalty shootout. But nevertheless, you know, there is always that, like, as you mentioned, Maradona. I mean, if he wanted to work a magic out of the pocket, out of nowhere, that could have possibly happened too, maybe in extra time as well. So you never know. Yeah.
Great stuff. Brilliant. Okay, next game. Let's go with a classic at the Nou Camp, where Barcelona beat Chelsea 5-1 to go through 6-4 in aggregate. Now, Barcelona were down from the first leg, weren't they? I think they lost 3-1 at Stamford Bridge. Rivaldo gave them the lead, put them back into the tie. Figo then made it 3-3 on the stroke of half-time, but Flo netted a goal for Chelsea, an away goal on the hour mark. And then carnage ensued. Danny levels for Barcelona. Rivaldo missed a penalty in the 85th minute. Blimey, this game had everything, didn't it?
Well, this is, to me, one of the most underrated Champions League matches. You know, quite often, not much been said about this game. I don't know why, but to me, it was definitely one of Barcelona's best nights in the Camp Nou. During the pre-Tiki-Taka Messi era and all that. Mm-hmm. You know, it was definitely one of the most famous nights. And of course, you know, as you mentioned, Chelsea took a 3-1 lead in the first leg at Stamford Bridge. That was Barcelona's first defeat in that season in the Champions League, in case you didn't know that. Yeah, it had everything. It had everything what you would expect from a classic Champions League night. Not to mention Dennis Suárez getting the red card. You know, when Flo scored that goal, I did kind of felt that, you know, maybe Chelsea might sneak in something here, because there's one thing problem with Barcelona is that their track record against English side isn't that really impressive.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, this wasn't a bad Chelsea team either, let's be real. I mean, okay, they didn't win the title in England, but they had great players, De Gea, Babayaro, Desailly, won a World Cup, Leboeuf as well, Gianfranco Zola, Deschamps. This is a great team, but this Barcelona, wow, I mean, as you said, it wasn't the tiki-taka days, but the players they had, Guardiola, Puyol, Rivaldo, Kluivert, Figo, it would be very, very difficult to call this one, to be fair, but yep, Barcelona snuck through.
Yeah, it is. Just unfortunately, they couldn't capitalize on that night and go on to win the Champions League that season, because pretty much right after that game, everything sort of went wrong for them that season, and it was the start of that sort of pre-dark era before when a certain Frank Rijkaard came over and took over the job, because there was a few years where Barcelona didn't look like they were the force to be reckoned with.
Absolutely, mate. I think Chelsea had an FA Cup final that summer as well, so yeah, they had a pretty decent season, to be fair. Right, next game, Portugal 2, England 2. I didn't watch this game. I was at an Usher concert, would you believe?
Okay.
Yeah, but I was getting text message alerts and people were cheering and whatnot in the arena when England was scoring, and someone was telling us what was going on with the penalty shootouts. And this one became famous when Ricardo took his gloves off in the shootout and saved Vassell's penalty. A topsy-turvy game for both nations, but again, when you got players like Rui Costa and Figo and Maniche, it was very, very difficult to bet against the Portuguese, and especially Cristiano Ronaldo, of course.
Yeah, this was one of those games where, you know, you even when you were a neutral, you were at the edge of your seat all the way, because, you know, you couldn't tell what's going to happen. Even when Portugal took the lead to that brilliant strike from Rui Costa, you know, somehow or other, I felt that England will always find a way in this game, and they did through Frank Lampard. And I think that this game, you know, was, I would say, it was a crossroad for England, because this would have been the perfect time for that golden generation and Sven-Goran Eriksson to finally take England to the next step and probably go and win something. But again, you know, England track record on penalties, that's another thing we need to talk about. Always hasn't been so good until recent the World Cup where they beat Colombia. A shame that that England generation couldn't really go that far. But you can't take away that Portuguese side. I mean, they were in a transition period whereby you could see the makeup of the squad was slowly changing from the Figo, Rui Costa days to a more new players, Maniche, Costina, of course, a 17-year-old Cristiano Ronaldo, Helder Postiga. Yeah, definitely one of those classic Euro games. In fact, I would say Euro 2004 was perhaps the best Euro for me. So if you looked at many of the games, even the group stages, there were plenty of classic games there.
Well, Euro 2004 is my favourite for obvious reasons, so I'm not going to go into it. Well, Greece won it, and yeah, there you go, right? But in terms of this game itself, mate, if you remember Michael Owen's goal, the opener, it was from a Castinha mistake. It was a fantastic finish from him, the way that he swiveled his body and hit it with the outside of his boot. But in true England fashion, forget the penalties, but Sol Campbell, he had a goal disallowed in the 90th minute, which kind of reminded me of France 98 when he had the goal disallowed against Argentina. It just wasn't going to be his night, was it?
Well, Sol Campbell must be thinking like, what is this going on again? When can I ever score against anybody right now? sometimes I guess, when I look back at all England's failure, I guess it was just that little bit of luck that wasn't on their side. They had a very good team back then, and people always... these days it's kind of unfair that people keep rating them as the David Beckham generation, full of razzmatazz, nothing to show about and all that, just because they're playing in the Premier League. But I think deep down, if you really look into, if you dissect those games that England played, including this one we're talking about, you could tell that there was that element of luck that was missing, that could have make or break England's fortune in that Euro.
Well, yeah, look, you can call it luck, but let's be 100% honest. If you look at England as a nation at international level, look, they haven't won the World Cup since 66. They've been in a couple of World Cup semi-finals. They've done all right at the Euros. But when are we going to turn around and say, well, they're just not good enough to be classed as one of the biggest teams in the world? Because, granted, you can have all the best players. And let's be real, that 2004 squad was arguably the best squad that they've ever had. Look at it from front to back again. David James wasn't a fantastic goalkeeper, but he had plenty of experience. Gary Neville, arguably the best right back the Premier League has ever seen. John Terry and Sol Campbell, two phenomenal central defenders. Ashley Cole, again, arguably the best left back the Premier League has ever seen. Then you've got Lampard, Gerrard, Scholes. Everyone's talking about who is the best out of the three, but they were in the same team. Owen, Rooney. Yep. And yet they still weren't able to win a major trophy. And this is what I keep saying to people. Until they actually become winners and do it consistently, like the Germans have done it, like the Brazilians, you can't class them as a world-class nation when it comes to an international level.
Yeah, I mean, it is debatable whether to argue whether that England team was world-class. But I also will look back at that game. The pivotal moment in that game was the substitution of how each of the team managers were exercising from the sideline. Beckham wasn't having a good game at all, and neither was Luis Figo. And both of them had to come out at some point, but only one manager was daring enough to take out his top man, and that was Luis Felipe Scolari. He was willing to gamble on a player called Helder Postiga,
yep,
who had a horrendous season with Spurs that year, in a very crucial Euro knockout competition game against England. Whereas, Sven didn't really have the nerve or the guts to really take that extra decision, to tweak that team a little bit, knowing that his captain isn't going to deliver at this point in this game. So that to me is another factor why sometimes England don't make it that far. Those very little important decisions that define everything what a football match should be.
Mm. Fantastic. Brilliant. All right, next game. Go to the 14th of May 2003. Juventus 3, Real Madrid 1. Juventus win 4-3 on aggregate. Takes them to the Champions League final, didn't it? Very end-to-end game. Trezeguet gave Juventus the lead, the 11th or 12th minute. Del Piero then made it 2. Buffon saving Figo's penalty. As people should know, Figo joined Real Madrid in very controversial circumstances. Nedved made it 3. But Zidane pulled one back for his new club against his former employers. But yeah, what was this one? One for you, mate.
Well, Juventus, when they used to play at the Del Alpi Stadium, you know, it's one of those venues that you can never, you know, can never be excited. It's very dull. It's very boring. Atmosphere is always, you know, horrendous. But for some reason, on this night, the fans turned up in full numbers. The entire stadium was packed. And I think, you know, when I remember this game very well because, you know, I was hoping that it's going to be an all-Italian final. But, you know, Real Madrid was still at their very best. This is the Galacticos Real Madrid, yep. Still at their zenith peak after knocking out United in the quarterfinal. Mm-hmm. So I just felt like maybe it's a little bit hard for this Juventus team. But when I saw the atmosphere, I realized, you know, that's it. They're going to win this game, definitely. And they were leading 3-2 on aggregate up when Del Piero scored. And then when the penalty came, I thought, here we go again. Is Juventus going to, you know, fall this time again, you know? Or did they push the panic button? But Buffon proving why, you know, if you remember, this is 2003 Buffon. By then, mm-hmm. He was, without a doubt, the best goalkeeper in the world. He proven on that night. And, of course, that brilliant goal from Tyrell Nedved, I could never forget that. A brilliant chip over Casillas. Yeah. I think that was one of the best goals in the Champions League that season.
Outside of his right boot as well, mate.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, look, this was a team that Marcelo Lippi had assembled, and without Zidane, a lot of people were questioning Juventus' credentials winning the Champions League. And, you know, okay, they lost in the final, didn't they, to Milan. It was the famous Shevchenko penalty, wasn't it?
Yep.
But it was a fantastic squad as well. Davids, Nedved, Trezeguet, Del Piero. You could call the Serie A a farmer's league. But in the day, when you got a team like Juventus there and the stars that they have, crikey, they could have achieved anything. And again, you know, as you mentioned, they played the Real Madrid side that had Ronaldo on the bench, for crying out loud, at R9.
yep. Yeah. I mean, this is a different time when Serie A football was still considered one of the best league mm-hmm. in the world. It was able to assemble all the big names in football. And, you know, teams like Roma and Lazio were still considered, you know, title challengers, just not a typical top 10 side. You know, it was still, you know, the era where Italian football was still considered at the highest level, unlike what it is today, where there's a lot of question mark to the point that Italy can't even qualify for a major tournament. So, yeah, I mean, and of course, you know, Juventus, they needed Marcelo Lippi, the same guy that brought them so much glory in the 90s. They needed him back to revive everything for them, like what you mentioned in the post-Zidane era, Juve weren't looking like they were going nowhere. And here comes Lippi. You know, he managed to assemble this brilliant team and still managed to win plenty of Scudettos. Just that one Champions League was, you know, and again, one penalty by Shevchenko made all the difference.
Now, for the final game. I don't know too much about this one. In fact, I know absolutely nothing about it. So hit me. Uzbekistan against Kuwait, 2006 AFC zone qualifier.
Well, you know, this game is definitely going to raise a lot of eyebrows when you mention to anyone. The reason why I choose this game is because if you go back at that time, this was the last group game whereby both teams were in contention for a playoff spot. If you didn't know the rules or the qualifying rules back then in the AFC zone, in the final group, you had two groups. Winners and runners-up get an automatic ticket to Germany, whereas mm-hmm. the third-place team from each respective group will have to play a playoff. And that playoff will play Trinidad and Tobago in another playoff. So Uzbekistan and Kuwait both had chance, but you know, Uzbekistan, I think they were just 1 point. They haven't won any game from their first 5 match. Whereas Kuwait they did win one game, so they had 3 points. And if you know Uzbekistan's football history, they are capable of choking at the very critical moment when they're expected to do something. And this could have been one of those games because Kuwait took a 2-0 lead. I think within the first 30 minutes, they were already 2-0 up. But Uzbekistan, they came back. They came back remarkably to win that game 3-2 to set up a match against Bahrain in the playoff. So, you know, when I was thinking of, you know, 5 most memorable match, I want to go for something that is niche, unique, that is hipster. This game, it was the first game came to my mind.
Mm. Do you know, the only thing I know about Uzbekistan is that they had Bob Houghton as their head coach. That's the only thing I know. But in terms of this game itself, who would you say were the standout players, and would we recognise any of them? Did they play in any of the major leagues?
Well, you know, the most standout player, if you remember, was a Dinamo Kiev striker by the name of Maxim Shachki.
Okay, yeah.
If you're not aware of who Shachki is, he was the player that was entrusted by Dinamo Kiev's legendary manager, Valery Labanovsky, to take over from a certain Andrei Shevchenko when he left for Dinamo for Milan in 1999. So he was one of those standout players in that side. And it's just a shame that, you know, when a country like Uzbekistan could have a striker who plays at such a top level, and, you know, they couldn't go far with him because there were always this other factor, you know, maybe the makeup of the squad isn't up to the mark to able to help him. But yeah, if I were to pick one player, that would be him.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Well, Sivan, appreciate your appearance on the show, mate. I know it's very late out there. Where are you, in Selangor? Is that right?
Yeah, it's only about 8:45 p.m. So no worries. It's Friday night. So
that's okay. I didn't want to put you out your way, but I appreciate you joining me and talking to me about your favourite game. So before I let you go, mate, is there anything that you want to mention? Anything you'd like to plug? Any Twitter, anything like that?
Well, you know, if anybody's interested to follow me on Twitter, you can follow me, SivanJohn_SivanJohn_ you know, I'm open to talk about anything in football. So yeah, please give me a shout out there. Or else, please do follow my podcast, The Bola Bola Show. We've got lots of interesting stuff going there. And of course, we definitely want to have Uncle Still to talk about Man United. And we have something in store for you. So you have to come on board.
Anytime, mate. Just give me some notice and I'll be there. Before I let you go, actually, what's with the Huddersfield obsession?
Okay. Well, 2011, I actually came to the UK to visit my uncle, who lives in Huddersfield.
Okay.
And, we couldn't go on to watch any Premier League games because of ticket issues. So he just suggested, why don't we go watch a town game? I said, why not? I mean, it's still football. Why not, right? And for me, it was a very surreal feeling to be able to experience English football stadium, the atmosphere and all that, in front of my own eyes. And up to that point, I never really had a club that I would follow and support. I had soft spot for so many good clubs, including United or Liverpool, Barca, Real Madrid, for the great things they've done. But I've never really been sort of like a fan of them. I was always, you know, on the fence, appreciating what's good. But on that day, I realized, you know, why don't I just pick Huddersfield Town? I mean, it's unique to be able to say that you're from Malaysia supporting Huddersfield Town. I don't think anybody has been a fan of that club in my country even until now. Even two seasons in the Premier League hasn't been able to convert anybody. So yeah, that's my story of Huddersfield Town.
Great stuff. Brilliant. Lovely. All right, mate. Well, look, thanks ever so much for your time. We'll do this again sometime. We'll do another show. What do you reckon?
Sure. I'm okay. I'm on for it.
Excellent. Wonderful. Right, those of you still listening, give us a follow on Twitter at @ShootTheFence. We also have an Instagram page. Take a look, because I've been uploading a lot of retro photographs from old magazines. Again, as I said on yesterday's show, it's from my loft, from my attic. Loads of old magazines, so I've been putting some up there. And also sound bites of previous podcasts. So until next time, ladies and gents, goodbye.